every time I finish a script and then have to start a new one the next week, I'm always like, that last one I wrote is the last one I'll ever be able to write. I'm never going to be able to write another one again. That was it. But every other time I write another one.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Another episode of Story and Craft. How are you doing? I'm Mark Preston, and I'm so glad to have you back for another episode. If this is your first episode, hey, thanks for checking it out. Gonna have a great one today. Asha Michelle Wilson, that is our guest. We're talking about what it's like to develop, write, and run a television show. You know, from somebody who does that for a living. She also acts a little bit here and there. Now, Asha has written for TV shows like FX's Archer and American Horror Story. She's writing on the new Netflix show that's going to be coming out called Agent King. And she's developing a show right now for Paramount Plus. She stays very busy. It's a great conversation about what it's like to run a TV show. Very interesting stuff. Hey, don't forget storyandcraftpod.com. That's the website. Anything you want to know about the show, if you want to send me a message, find social media links, anything, pretty much everything you want to learn about the show is at storyandcraftpod.com. Okay, so let's get right after it. Today, it's Asha Michelle Wilson Day, right here on Story and Craft. So how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Mark. How are you?
Fantastic. Where are you joining me from today?
I am in Encino, California, in my home.
You know, it's so funny. I think I just spoke with somebody the other day who lives in Encino. So it's kind of a way to kind of get out of the hustle and bustle of, did I say hustle and bustle? That's one of those phrases I never use. But hustle and bustle of Los Angelesness. Which in my time out there, I can appreciate the desire for a lack of traffic.
I understand. It's also the parking is way better.
So are you originally from Encino, or did you kind of gravitate out there just to be in the business?
When I first moved out here, I started in North Hollywood and then Studio City and then bought a house in Encino. I'm originally from Southern Florida, so kind of a complete opposite side of the country. But I came specifically to Encino because I just found a house that I really liked. That was really, and I needed to be close as possible to any studio that I might have to work at. So this felt equidistant enough while still, again, having great parking.
Now, did you head to Los Angeles for the sake of acting, or was it writing, or was there a specific career goal when you were heading out there, or was it just like anything I can do, I want to do it?
I came out here knowing for a fact that I wanted to write scripted television. That was the number one thing that I knew I wanted to do. I also wanted to act, but I felt like I felt more confident in my writing abilities than my acting abilities coming out here. And I felt like, you know, gun to my head, if I could choose one, writing would be it. So that was really the impetus for coming out here.
You've been writing, of course, for some different shows. Do you find that it's more fun to work on projects that are yours, or is it kind of the ultimate goal for you to create your own project and you're the writer and then you kind of delegate some of those duties?
Show running has really been my number one goal. I think I like working on other. I like working with other people, and it is always fun to help somebody else make their dream come true. I think right now my focus is making my dreams come true, for lack of a better phrase. I think I really love all of the nitty-gritty stuff that goes into creating your own show, even, you know, picking out the wigs that people have to wear and going into the post department and, you know, going through that whole process. So I think that's where my focus is now, after learning a lot from working on other people's shows.
Now, mostly, I've always wondered this as an actor, how often as a writer do you need to be on set or on location? Like, for instance, you wrote on American Horror Story and I see Scream Queens, but I know those are shot in New Orleans. At least I think at least one of the seasons.
Somewhere, yeah.
It seems like nowadays, especially after COVID, and everybody can work remotely, as long as you've got your computer and a phone, you could be anywhere. Or do they like you to be there? What's kind of the protocol for that?
It really depends on the show and the showrunner. They kind of can decide how they want to handle things. I think specifically on, you know, American Horror Story, some seasons were shot in New Orleans, many were shot in LA. We had kind of one liaison between the writer's room and the set that would go, and the writer for the episode would often be on set as well. Nowadays, I know there are some directors who stay home and or stay in their own little thing and have the full thing set up, but I do think there is a certain energy to being on set that a lot of the writers that I've spoken with and in my experience, that you just can't really beat being on set in a certain way. And so, I think people have different preferences for sure. I really miss being on set and like being on set. So that's always something that I love, but it really depends on the show.
Well, one of the things I'm curious about, I would never profess to be a professional screenwriter, but I like to sometimes sit down with Final Draft? Is that what it is? I always forget the name of the software, but I'll fart around with it. But I always kind of like looking at it from as a hobby right now, and maybe one of these days I'll sell one. Do you prefer the TV realm? Because, I mean, really, that's more of a writer's medium, where movies are more of a director's medium. Do you prefer TV? Do you prefer, you know, feature-length films, or do you even have a preference?
I used to have a strong preference to TV. I think I was always a TV girl, and I think there was maybe growing up, a lot of people, if you said you wanted to work in Hollywood, they assumed you wanted to write movies, because no one really thought about writing TV as an option in those days. So I think I really dug my heels in of knowing that, no, I want to do TV, not movies, because people were just telling me that I had to write movies. But now, having written both, I really enjoy both. I think I slightly have more of a preference towards television, because I like the longer format of telling a character's story through multiple episodes, multiple seasons, and getting to see the supporting character's story, which you don't get to see as much of in a feature-length film. But on the flip side of it, I do think that features have the nice thing of just having that fully rounded story, and you can kind of tell that beginning, middle, end, and take the audience on its own journey. But I would say 10% more I like TV storytelling more.
I always thought it was interesting how the two are different, you know, and how you can cycle through different directors on a show. And it's, and after a while, especially if a show's been on for a while, from the people I've spoken with, the actors, that is, there's almost like an ownership that they take for the of the character, because it doesn't matter who's directing, they kind of already know who they are, you know. So have you ever seen the Netflix show Love, the Jed Apatow produced?
Yes.
There's kind of a whole storyline that the lead is actually ends up being a I don't know if he ever really wrote. I think he had a story treatment. I forgot, but it kind of showed the writer's room and kind of like, you know, it seemed like almost like a war room at times. Is that kind of the you know when you got a number of writers together, is it sort of a battle a little bit, or, you know, for like who can kind of get their thing in, or do you have one person that's kind of the captain of the show? You know, what's that like in a writing room?
I think, again, it does depend on the showrunner. It's funny, the thing you said about directing, I had a director friend of mine once say that coming on to direct an episode of a TV show is kind of like being a step-parent. Like, you have some power, but not too much power, and you kind of don't want to step on toes, but, you know, you have to be there. But on the writer's room side of things, I think, you know, there are some comedy rooms especially that can feel very much like a battle. Who can get the best joke in? I've heard of some rooms that have a whiteboard where they mark for every joke that every person has. So there's just a running tally of seeing who has the most jokes in an episode. I've never been in a room like that, thankfully. I think it would stress me out. But I think most of the rooms I've been in, luckily, have, you know, felt more like friends hanging out, felt more like, you know, we tell stories about our lives and see if they make sense within the context of the show. And, you know, everyone has the characters that they gravitate towards more, and you sort of pitch to that. But like I said, there are other rooms that, especially, there's always a hierarchy. So that can feel like war. You know, you have your, like you said, you have your captains and your generals and all of that. And so there is sort of a hierarchy that everyone has to respect. But I think if you're lucky, it feels more like a hangout that you're paid to do and less like a stressful battle.
The last thing I did was a miniseries. So, of course, each episode was, I think they had like maybe a couple of episodes with one director, a couple with another. I was only there for a couple days. So, I mean, I'm kind of a small cog in a big machine. But I kind of found it interesting that I knew how many rewrites come in. And I like the way they always Every rewrite comes on a colored script. Like, it's the teal rewrite or the blue rewrite. Now, I'm colorblind. Yeah. So,
my God.
So I'm, well, not every color, but a number of the colors apparently they were using. Some sitting going, okay, orange and red. Don't know which one's which. Some trying to hunt down a PA going, I need help. Which color is this? And I'm not, no, they're sitting there going, okay, this guy's got some issues. Now, did you come from a family of creative folks, or are you kind of the first out of the gate to, you know, do something creative like this?
I'm definitely the first to do something professionally. My mom really loved writing novels. She wanted to be a journalist, but ended up going to school for more business, computer type things. But I did grow up in a very entertainment-loving family. We watched a lot of movies and watched a lot of TV shows. And, you know, I remember things that my parents introduced me to. My mom was really into Star Trek The Next Generation, and my dad was really into action movies, and now I'm really into Doctor Who and the Fast and Furious franchise. So I think they definitely handed off some of that to me. But no one was really in the entertainment business professionally, just a purveyor of TV and film.
Well, that's cool. I mean, that's sometimes all it takes is, you know, parents or, you know, an influence that they're exposed. Kind of like people that are musicians, their parents a lot of times expose them to a wide variety of things, you know. I sometimes worry if my kids choose to go into this industry that it's, God only knows, man, my influences, or the things I enjoy are all over the place. I mean, what were you, though? What were you growing up watching? Movies, TV? What were the things that are like, kind of like, they are like, you call back and go, man, that movie, just, you could watch it over and over again.
Yeah. I also just realized I misused the word purveyor, and as a writer, I had to say it before I... before it got in my head. So I think growing up, there was definitely, comedy was really the big thing that I really connected with. I think, of course, SNL, I feel like anyone who writes comedy in some regard connects to SNL at various points. I think Mel Brooks was really a big one for me. Blazing Saddles and History of the World Part 1 and The Producers were.
Do you think
really
Blazing
pivotal.
Saddles could come back out right now? Do you think that?
Oh, everyone always asks me that.
Satire is, I mean, when well executed, is so brilliant. You know,
sure.
I nobody took any of it seriously. You know, but
yeah,
I wonder, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I think they did it in the right way. I think Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor working on it and having such a great cast and. Actually a great message that was really smart. I think satire's changed in so many ways over the years. I don't know if it could come out right now. I think if someone was making it and offered it to me, I'm not sure I would say yes, because it would have to be done exactly right for to get away with it. But I mean, I'm sure there are people out there that could figure out how to do it now in the right way that, you know, but, you know, I think Mel Brooks hit the pinnacle of it, so I don't know if anyone could beat it. So maybe they shouldn't, not just on a public standpoint, but also creatively.
God, I remember in elementary school watching Spaceballs, and, you know, being Jewish, it's like, I get a lot of it, but some of it going, you know, in retrospect going, man, there's some things that ended up, you know, I don't think the teachers quite got that was going on in some of the Mel Brooks stuff. So I kind of felt, we felt like on the inside, you know, we knew some stuff.
Right, yeah.
Now, what made you kind of lean towards writing as opposed to being on camera? Was that something you were like, yeah, well, you like kind of being behind the scenes, or is just the creative process of writing is more fulfilling than being on camera?
I think that writing just came easier. Maybe it was just because I, you know, you can write on anything. I would write stories in journals that I got. I would get journals for Christmas and write stories in them. I would borrow my mom's laptop in the computer room back when we had computer rooms and just, you know, write something on her laptop. And so I think it was more easily accessible growing up. But at the same time, I went to theater camp and I did high school theater and I would shoot things on this little video camera with my friends, and sometimes I was in it, sometimes I wasn't. But I think I kind of knew that if I was gonna wanna be in something, I'd probably have to write myself into it. I don't think anyone ever told me that. It just felt like that was what I was gonna have to do. So it felt like if I wanted to be on camera, I was going to have to write first in order to get to that place.
Well, I wonder, like, when you are writing, when you are creating a story, You know, I ask musicians, is it a melody or is it a lyric that kind of kicks off the song? For you, writing a TV show, is it a character that kind of sparks a whole story for you? Is it an idea about a story that kind of gets things rolling? What's kind of what comes first to get the ball rolling for you?
It's usually dialogue. It's usually, I have a big notes app on my phone that's just funny lines that I'll come up with while, you know, I'm on a walk or...
I thought I was the only one who did that. Thank you. You kind of validated my weirdness, you know.
Oh, good. I mean, it might just be the two of us.
Dude, we can form a club, you know. The dudes will be
there
minimal.
There we go, yeah.
But... Because, I mean, isn't that kind of like, you'll see like a string of words together, like they'll pop in your mind for no reason. But of course, you got to fill in everything around it, you know.
So, but, of course, yeah.
So is it mostly when you are making your notes, is it kind of like not just the line, but is it then kind of evolving into what the bigger story could be?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, there are some projects that I come on to that I already know what the story is. You know, I'm brought onto them, so the characters are already in place, so it's really just about fleshing them out. But if I'm really starting something from scratch, let's say I have a funny back and forth between two people, usually within that back and forth, there's some foundation of, okay, this person thinks like this, and this person thinks like this. So I can kind of flesh out the characters from there. I'm trying to think if there's an example that I specifically have, but I can't think one right now. But I think, you know, once I have that, you know, back and forth, and then I have the characters, I sort of then flesh out the characters of like, okay, this person said this sarcastic thing, why would they say that, and what's their character background, and the person who responded, same thing. And then, you know, I'll kind of take it from there. Unless, I mean, there are times when I have a story idea that is more of a plot driven thing, and then I have to figure out, okay, who would be the most funny people to make this plot interesting, or the most, you know, interesting people to make this plot fun.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm writing, they say the common theory is don't cast it while you're writing it. But, you know, in my mind, when you're writing it, don't you automatically start getting personality traits and physicality and things that some actor may represent? So when you're writing, do you do that? I mean, not necessarily you're casting it, but kind of where you can have a visualization in your head of who's saying these words, you know? Do you do that?
Every so often, it depends on the project. There was a project that I wrote very specifically with myself and a British actor comedian in mind. And when I was in London last year, I met with him, and now he's on the project. So
really?
Sometimes it does work out, yes. Other times, you know, I think there are some projects where I've written it with a specific actor in mind, and then within the next year, the actor becomes so huge that I'm sure they are booked out for 4 years, and I'm like, who knows if they'll be able to do this project? So, you know, it can go both ways, but I do think it can help to have a type in mind, like, even if it's not physically, even if it's just someone who, you know, can do a certain kind of comedy. Like, I think, you know, the style of comedy that Tiffany Haddish does is very different than the style of comedy that, let's say, Issa Rae does. You know, they have different styles and different ways of speaking and different mannerisms. And if I was writing a character, you know, keeping in mind the way that one speaks over the other might just help make the read more interesting of someone reading that script or sending it to someone, really making it feel like, oh, this is a character who I can understand the way that they speak and the way their comedy is coming through because you had someone in mind.
Now, I got a question as an actor, and I think I want to ask this question on behalf of many other actors. Why are there so many rewrites? You know, what exactly is the impetus for the rewrite? Because if you're kind of day of, you know, you're shooting a scene, is it, you know, is it just you have a lot of chefs in the kitchen sometimes? Or is it that it's a constant creative process? Something maybe sparks like, oh, gosh, before they do it, let me throw this idea out there. Or is it just driven that somebody in the production chain says, hey, let's change this up a little bit? When you see rewrites or requests for rewrites or when they come in, what really is the impetus for it typically?
Yeah, I think when it comes to rewrites, the two most important things are you need them to like it enough to spend money to make it, and you need to like it to care enough to make it. And some, you know, you have to keep those things in balance. And I think there are often a lot of voices between actors, producers, directors, even sometimes, you know, the a production manager could be like, can we make this, you know, a less expensive location? You know, can we use one of our standing sets? Can we, you know, a second AD is going to be calling you, asking you questions about that. And so I think there are a lot of reasons why things get rewritten. I think in the earlier steps of the process and the sort of development stages, things get rewritten because you want the executives to like it enough to push it forward. And, you know, and then once you get more people on board, you know, sometimes a director will come on board and have a great idea for a character moment that happened to me recently. And so that caused a rewrite. And then an actor has come on board for a project, and that happened on a different project once where they were like, oh, this situation that you wrote for my character actually happened to me in real life. Do you mind adding a few lines or pieces of dialogue based on the real situation? And I was like, oh yeah, because that's very funny and it's going to be more true to you. But then once you actually get into production, a lot of those changes tend to be ways to make it less expensive. Whether it's, like I said, moving something onto a set, or, you know, we can't get that indoor location, can it be an exterior? Or, you know, you wrote this as day, can it be night, or vice versa? And that usually tends to be the bigger changes.
Yeah, that's got to be rough sometimes, because, you know, when you change one piece, it affects everything down the line sometimes. So you got to think, okay, where did this go? And, you know, that's maybe that's when you're working in a team that makes it a little bit easier, because somebody may catch it and go, hey, by the way, if we change it tonight, then the very next couple few scenes, or, you know, it may do something. But for somebody who's not really acquainted, what, or even how do you define showrunner? What is a showrunner in your mind? They're creative and business and whatever responsibility in the process of getting a show made.
In the simplest terms, a showrunner is an executive producer and the head writer of the writer's room of the show. They're often, not always, the person who created the show, who initially came up with the concept or was brought onto the project. Sometimes they can be someone else that came in to help shepherd the project along. But I think, you know, in a more of like metaphorical terms, they are kind of the captain of the ship. I think the tone of a set and of a writer's room is brought on by the showrunner. The people who are hired are often friends or past co-workers of the showrunner. And so they really do set the bar for how things are going to be run. They're running the show. And so a lot of the decisions that are made on a show, when you watch it and you're like, you know, when it comes to the costumes or who was cast or what location it was or whatever, are oftentimes the showrunner's choices. They can also be the network exec's choices, to be fair, but you would want it to be the showrunner because that's their vision that's being made most of the time.
I think writing has got to be one of those real, like any writer, anything like that, where you're just sitting, you blank page, well, it's really a blank blinking cursor, you know, on a screen. And it's got to be really a lot of self-starting, a lot of motivation, starting internally, which begs the question, you know, this is almost like homework, at least. Were you good in school? I mean, was school like your jam? I mean, were you a creative writer in school? Were you just like a daydreamer?
I was a little bit of both. I think I loved TV and I loved escaping through the world of TV. I was good in school. I think looking back on it, at the time, I think I was harder on myself. I was like, oh, I was never good in like math and science. My mom was like, you got solid A's and B's. I don't know what you're talking about, but maybe I just didn't like it that much. But I think It's funny you say the thing about the blinking cursor. I was just telling a friend the other day, I was like, every time I finish a script and then have to start a new one the next week, I'm always like, that last one I wrote is the last one I'll ever be able to write. I'm never going to be able to write another one again. That was it. But every other time I write another one. So I think, I think I was a little bit like that in school. I think the blank page can be quite daunting, but I really like connecting with people. I felt that same way, like I said, in school. I was on, you know, the newspaper and the yearbook and high school theater and, you know, student councils and all of that. I liked working with people and talking with people and connecting with them. And I think TV is now my way to do that, in which I get paid.
Well, did you go to college for this? Or where did you go to college? Where'd you go?
Yes. I went to Elon University in North Carolina, liberal arts school, and I studied a major that no longer exists there. That was media arts and entertainment. They renamed it because they realized it didn't cover enough. But I minored in narrative cinema because, again, it was like, oh, you can only do film. But my senior year, I convinced the dean of communications to let me do an independent study in which I just read books about TV and watched TV and wrote a bunch of pilots and spec scripts.
That's really cool. That's like,
thank you.
I think a lot of people in different creative careers, I don't say that they know everything that they need to learn, but they know where to start looking and kind of, you know, be curious. And just, you know, as a screenwriter, I mean, I'm assuming a few folks are going to listen to this who want to do that or are already doing it. I think the last one I read, I didn't actually read it. I'm actually looking at it right now, but I bought the book, then I got the audiobook because I was, you know, I'm lazy apparently. Save the Cat.
Oh, yes.
What are some of your favorite screenwriting books? If you're going to give like a top three or something for people to dive into, you know.
I would say for movie writing, Save the Cat is great. I think it's a really great baseline of like knowing which tent poles you have to hit in a story and how to build that structure. For a fun one that is not necessarily how to write a story, but I think says a lot about TV writing, Kristen Newman, I think is her name, wrote What I Was Doing While You Were Breeding, which is about her kind of travel adventures while also being a TV writer. And I think there's a lot of behind the scenes of working in this industry that she talks about along with her other adventures that are amazing. And then I would say, honestly, this isn't a book, but I think reading as many scripts as you can. That was really what I did in my independent study and still do a lot to this day, is just getting my hands on, you know, my favorite TV scripts and movie scripts and seeing how they wrote character descriptions and how they wrote dialogue. And it's very cool.
They say it's one page per minute, roughly, right? But I think it's Quentin Tarantino. I read one of his screenplays, looked over one of his screenplays, and there is a lot of specificity in what's supposed to be happening on the screen. And so, of course, that's going to make the script fatter, you know, because there's so much description. Yeah. But I kind of like that as an actor. I think that makes, that kind of lets theater of the mind kind of come into play, let you know what's happening before you even get
absolutely.
On set. I know I'm kind of in the weeds on this, but I'm kind of curious, when you write, do you put little things that are like set dressing or the way the light is or something that, or maybe characters' mannerisms. Do you like to put that in there or do you like to focus mostly just on dialogue?
I don't tend to do too much of it because I feel like that can often step on the way the director might want to do something or the way the actor might want to do something. You know, I also work in animation and I've written on Archer. And in that, you know, I really have to put in, you know, certain fight stuff and things like that because the animators need that. So you have to kind of say, you know, like this character clotheslines another character, like a wrestler kind of thing. But in live action stuff, I do it a lot less unless I feel like it's vital for understanding what's happening in the scene. So in terms of like the lighting kind of thing, there was something I was writing recently where a character, you think they're going to get attacked in a shower and the lighting really had to be like psycho in the shower scene. And so I would write that in because it does speak to how you're kind of visualizing it as you're reading it. But most of the time I stay away from it so I don't step on the other people I will be collaborating with the script.
The writing is kind of, it's kind of two rails. One is you come up with this whole idea that's yours and you come up with it and try to get, you know, bought, or you come into an existing production and you are one of the writers. Do you have a preference on one or the other? Do you like to come into something that's already in flow and to kind of write to the tone of what's already going on? Or do you like to kind of create your own thing and let it, you know, focus on that?
You know, on paper, they would seem kind of, I don't know, actually. I think if I'm working on someone else's show, if it's a story or a type of comedy that I can really connect to, that's the most important thing to me. But, you know, when it's your story, there is a certain passion that you have for it that is just can make it a little bit more exciting. On paper, I would prefer, you know, kind of making my own story come through. But, you know, it can be a lot harder. There's a lot more pressure. The stakes are on you. When you're in someone else's room, it's like going to someone else's party. You're not worried if the dip is full or if, you know, someone clogs the bathroom or if there's enough guests there. But if it's your party...
It sounds like some very specific and interesting party notes. Like... Like, there's a little thought that went into this. Maybe that's the writer in you. You don't think, just party. Okay, what's going on? How full is the dip?
Specifics.
Specific. Somebody's having an anxiety attack because there's no plunger. You know, that's... Let's say you are writing on a show, and it is a very well-established celebrity, an actor, performer. Does it make it a little bit easier because, you know, like if you're writing for Seth Rogen or for somebody that's really, you know, their tone, does it make it easier or harder for you to kind of get, you know, down the middle and hit the crosshairs?
I just had this come up with a very, very well-known award-winning actress. And I think... On one hand, let's say if it's something that, if it's a character that you know well, if it's not a new character this actress is playing, let's say, it can make it a little easier because you know the baseline of it. You know the certain mannerisms that this character has. But if it's the specific specific actor, that can be a little nerve-wracking because, you know, you want it to be something that they can connect to and understand and, you know, like. yeah, I just saw The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, the Nicolas Cage movie, and I went to it was great. I loved it. I went to the event. It was a WGA event, and they had a Q&A with the director and writers afterwards, and they were talking about having written this really as a love letter to Nick Cage, but also sending it to him and kind of having that worry of like, ooh, I hope he doesn't think we're making fun of him. And I related to that because when you're writing something specifically for an actor, there's a fine line you have to walk. And so I do like it, though, because I think it can get, again, make that character very specific to the person. But there is some pressure to it as well.
Some people may allude to some of the projects he's in, like, oh, dear Lord, really? You give him a great script, great movie, he knocks it out of the park every time, you know? I think there's something, I'm in New Orleans, and somebody once told me... that, you know, because all the cemeteries here are above ground, like crypts, you know, they're not like, they don't, weird. I didn't think I'd discuss cemeteries on this show ever, but here we go.
Well,
but he apparently, the sea level, you have to bury people above ground. You know, if anybody's listening, Google New Orleans cemeteries, you'll see I'm not that weird. But apparently his is, he created one that was, somebody said it was a pyramid. So whenever he dies, I'm like, some people may think, what a weirdo. I'm like, you know what? Everything he does is just his own Nicolas Cage creative thing, you know. I'm like, you gotta love that. I mean,
something the director said that I really liked was that it had to be specific to Nick Cage. It was written for him, and thank God he said yes, because he does have this wild array of film that he's done, but he also has such like universal public love and support and like memification that you don't see in a lot of actors. And so I'm like, hey, I love that he has a crypt. That's amazing.
Now, yeah. I see comedy showing up a few times. You mentioned Saturday Night Live, some of the programs you've worked on. Do you have a preference on genre? What do you like to work on?
I think I always gravitate towards comedy. Usually the ideas I want to have. So if I come up with like a sci-fi idea, it's a sci-fi comedy. If it's fantasy comedy. But I think... You know, after leaving Horror Story, I think I had a little bit of time where I was like, I just want to do comedy and nothing else. But now I'm sort of coming back around to more genre-heavy genres in terms of, like, sci-fi, a little bit of horror, fantasy sort of thing, just because I think there's a lot to explore in that world, especially when it comes to comedy. Again, you know, you have Blazing Saddles, that was a Western comedy, and Spaceballs, space comedy. And so I think I really love blending those. And I also, I really love a romance. That's just my ooey gooey heart. I am a romantic optimist. And so I like a happy ending. I like a happy ending kiss. So yeah, I think those are the ones I'm gravitating towards most right now. Which is all of them, I guess.
I mean, I guess it's a great vocation for someone who's a little late ADHD, not saying that. I mean, it is the entertainment business after all. But the whole idea that you can go from genre to genre, you can go to the, if you get kind of not tired, but you're kind of burnt on one thing, maybe you're like, oh man, I could do this thing though. And now you're re-inspired. So, you know, you're not relegated to just one thing. Now, as far as shows go, like what's on right now that's inspiring you, or that you just, hey, it could be just something you like watching because you can just kind of chill out and not even think. And, you know, what do you like watching? Or maybe the writers for the shows you think are just excellent.
You know, I know everyone always talks about this show, but I think it's worthy of it, is Abbott Elementary. I think I have a few mutual friends with Quinta. I don't really know her personally, but I think having seen her at parties and events and stuff, I'm just in awe of how she was able to make such a fun, smart show that just kind of across the board, everybody loves it. And I think that's just incredible, and it's so great. And it is, again, a heartwarming watch. I really loved The Gilded Age. I just enjoyed watching that story, and the kind of escapism of it was fun. And I'm trying to think if there's any, and I'm a sucker for adult animation. I love a Bob's Burgers. I loved Archer before I wrote on it and still love it.
Really? Well, that's gotta be kind of cool to like something and then you show up in the room and like, oh, I'm one of the people doing it. You know, I remember I used to watch Family Guy back in the day. My kids used to call it Daddy Cartoon. Now it's like, now they love watching it. And of course, as older teenagers, like they get far much more of the humor. But you know, you mentioned something about sci-fi or fantasy. Have you caught, Outer Range on, I think it's on Amazon Prime, Josh Brolin.
I haven't.
It's one of those shows, like you're watching going, okay, all right, they're going a little bit here. No, like you're like, holy shit. Okay. This is a thing. I always like being taken off, caught off guard. Like I didn't expect something.
I fully understand that. One of the shows that was actually probably my favorite show of this year so far was Reacher. Mm-hmm. I loved Reacher, and I think it really surprised me. I loved it, and I think I really was along for the ride. I was really caught off guard by a lot of the elements of it, and I think about that show a lot. I'm surprised it didn't come to my head first.
That is so funny you said that, because I saw that, and I was like, it's not just the way it's written, but there's kind of a rhythm and a cadence to how the lines are delivered. Seems like an overall concept about the way the show is done. I like going, okay, I don't see anything else like this on TV. I like that, you know, and with so much out there, with all the streamers and everything, it seems like everything that could be out there is out there. So it's nice to be surprised. Like, oh, I didn't see this coming.
Now
I did see you got BET. You're on the list of 6 black women showrunners who inspired TV's diverse renaissance. That's kind of a cool recognition.
No pressure.
Yeah, I was just about to, that was going to be the follow-up. Hollywood being Hollywood, the industry being what it is, once you start getting some attention, is there kind of like a, now people are paying attention, this is game day, I got to perform. How does that affect you to now be coming on folks' radars?
Yeah, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it just makes me think about the difference between public success and private success. I think during lockdown, I was honestly working more than I ever had. I was pitching almost every day, and I was in general meetings, and I was writing hours and hours. I was in London, and I was working from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m. when I got into a Zoom writer's room, from 5 p.m. until midnight, and then I'd write till 3 a.m. and then sleep and then wake up and do it again. And nobody knew about anything I was working on. It was all just like my private kind of success. And then fast forward to now, when it's amazing to be on lists and these articles coming out and having more eyes on me in that way. But I think, you know, it in a weird way, it's not necessarily as fulfilling as the kind of private success that you get from just being enjoying the stuff that you're working on. So I think for me, I just try to focus on like, I'm so lucky to get to do this thing I've been dreaming of doing since I was 6. And, you know, I'm sure there's like one day a month where I have a lot of anxiety about it, but most of the time, you know, it's kind of the like, I get to work on a show that once I dressed as a character on Halloween as, like, I get, you know, like things like that are just really cool and exciting. And I think that helps keep everything leveled.
Now, do you have any siblings?
I have half siblings on my dad's side, quite a few, but I'm my mom's only kid. But actually last summer I flew out my oldest half sister. She's 19 now. She was 18 at the time. And I flew her out to LA, and that was really exciting to kind of like see LA through her eyes. She, you know, wanted to see the Hollywood Walk of Fame and all of that, but none of them work in entertainment. So I'm kind of the only one that's in this.
Yeah. Field. Whenever I go to LA, to me, it's always an eating expedition. You know, it's always like in and out. I try to, you know, I was a big fan of Anthony Bourdain, and his thing was always when he gets when he lands at LAX, he always goes to In-N-Out Burger. I'm like, that became my thing. I always do that now because of him. It's my like paying homage in a greasy way. Yeah.
I love that.
But I'm always curious because folks who do this, my intrigue is, okay, a lot of people who do it are either only children or maybe they have older siblings, but they're kind of in their own head a lot for whatever reason, you know, like my generation. You know, I was speaking with LaMonica Garrett recently, and we're talking about how, you know, your latchkey kids back in the day, you're kind of left alone. You're in your own head doing your own thing. Were you kind of, as a kid, creative, like you need your own creative, like you time, or were you very gregarious?
I also want to say you have a Bourdain-like voice, which is, I'm a huge fan of his, so that's a big compliment.
Oh, he's my spirit animal, and I appreciate that.
Oh, great.
I'm going to carry that around the rest of the day.
Good. I'm glad you should. I think I was also a latchkey kid, and but I was an outgoing kid. I moved around a lot growing up. I didn't go to a school for more than 2 years until high school. So I was kind of all over the place. So I had to sort of be outgoing and energetic and make friends. I was kind of the kid who went up to people on the playground and was like, "Do you want to be my friend?" And most of the time they said yes. So, you know, I wasn't very shy at all. I really liked doing like impressions that I wasn't good at. I liked doing accents for people. So I was definitely more gregarious.
Yeah, it's so funny how many of the people in this industry were actually, they're actually fundamentally more shy, more reserved, but when they're on camera, it's like, ta-da, you know. But what are you working on now? What's coming up in the pipeline, either things that are already kind of in the queue or things maybe you're wanting to kind of get into a queue?
So I'm in development with Paramount Plus right now on a project that's a remake, reboot, I guess, of the 1990s film Soap Dish that starred Whoopi Goldberg and Sally Fields. And so we're kind of in that process right now. And then I'm pitching out a few projects. I'm also working on season 14 of Archer, which is exciting. And I'm also working on a movie with Vanessa Hudgens and Alexandra Shipp that the amazing Kimmy Gatewood is going to direct. And so we're kind of in early development on that as well. And so kind of, you know, got a few different fires going and moving them all forward.
And I don't know how you do that because I got to focus on one thing at a time. I say that.
I've
got all kinds of crap going on in my three teenagers, but Paramount Plus, they're putting out some good stuff. I was a big fan of 1883.
Yeah, that's like their biggest hit.
The Paramount Plus thing, is that something rough ETA? And well, of course, you know, man plans, God laughs, of course. But I mean, what, especially in this business, when are you thinking that make your next project could be rolling out?
Well, I did, in terms of the next project that I have coming out, the project that I worked on a show for Netflix called Agent King that should be coming out this fall. In terms of the Paramount project, that is still a little unknown. I'm hoping sooner rather than later. But I think in this industry, it's kind of always, like you said, you make a plan and execs laugh, really, I think you should say. But hoping sooner rather than later for everything, really.
Well, that's pretty cool. We'll tell you what I do before we wrap up. I always have what I call my seven questions, purely just fun. First question I always love asking because I'm a food guy. You mentioned Anthony Bourdain, so it's right down the middle of where I'm at. What is your favorite comfort food? That thing that's like, if you've had a rough day or maybe it's a whole lot of work, you're like, you know, you could go eat healthy, but you know, I'm just going to go get this. Or maybe your comfort food is healthy. Who knows?
I really love cooking. A meal that if I've had a rough day that is actually like not difficult to put together but really soothes my soul is I'll make a steak and mashed potatoes and put like a bunch of truffle salt on it. And
truffle
that feels
salt.
Like a little elevate. Yeah. And it feels a little fancy and very like warm and cozy but does not take long to put together.
Yeah, you're kind of like me. It's like, what's that one little thing you can do to kind of like make it seem a little fancier? Especially, what's nice when you're doing it just for yourself. You're like, Look, I made this. You know, nobody's around to notice it, yeah. But you're proud of yourself. Now, if you were to sit down with three people for a cup of coffee, and it could be living or not, who would those three people be you would love to talk story with for a few hours? Whenever I ask this question, I always get the coffee bean and tea leaf across from the Directors Guild on Sunset. That coffee shop always comes to my mind whenever I ask this question. So, because I guess that's where I used to post up with my computer and do work.
Sure.
But who would you like to sit down with?
Madeline Kahn, Kevin Klein, love him, and Tracy Ellis Ross. I think she'd just be fun.
You know, Madeline Kahn is funny going back to Mel Brooks' movie.
Yeah.
I'm Frankenstein. What am I drawing? How can I brain fart on that? Anyway, Madeline Kahn.
Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. I had like a little, I remember being a kid, have a little micro crush on her. Like, it's like she was.
Micro crush, macro crush. Come on.
She was, I mean, because I was a kid, she was older, but she's funny. I was like, I like that. Sure. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Now, that brings me actually to my next question. Who was your celebrity crush when you were a kid?
Oh, when I was a kid.
Oh, hey, you want to bring up like who it is now? We're going to take that answer also. No worries.
I was going to say, I don't know if I have one now. They're all great. When I was a kid, I think, when I was really little, it was a classic Jonathan Taylor Thomas type crush.
Oh, yeah.
That was definitely like my first on-screen one. Also, Jeremy Sumpter from the live-action Peter Pan was a big one. Those were like my first, like, oh my gosh, they're so pretty kind of crushes, for sure.
When you only had three networks, I mean, you had these big teen heartthrobs that were like, okay, now you got a gazillion different shows on. It's not like everybody's watching, you know. Anyway, yeah. You know, I can get in that time machine over and over again and just go tell my kids, like, say, there were three networks once upon a time.
Back in my day.
Yeah. Now, the next question I got, if you were to go to an exotic island, it's actually somewhere you want to be. You're going to be there a year, though. And there's no streaming, no nothing. You can bring a DVD of a movie and you can bring one album with you for a year. And that's all your entertainment. What are you going to bring with you?
The movie would be Clueless. I love that movie. The album would probably be, I'm blanking on the exact name of it, but it's the Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong duets album.
Okay.
It's like a very thick album, but, that one, I think they just, I love their voices together.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. It's funny. Clueless, I think, has some of the most memorable dialogue. I mean, there's so many quotes from that movie, but it's kind of not got lost in time, but you gotta have remembered the movie that, you know,
I remember it. I remember it enough for a lot of people, I think.
Now, if you were to sit down from the time you wake up till the time you go to bed, and you're to define a perfect day, what would the component parts be of that perfect day?
Okay, I would probably schedule the day around food. So if I could do like a nice big breakfast in the morning with like blueberry pancakes and like bacon and eggs, and then I would want to, part of me wants to just say Disneyland actually as the whole day. But I'm going to go for big breakfast, maybe going to the beach, and then having like a nice like lobster roll by the beach, and then going to see like, you know what I really loved? This would actually be a part of my perfect day. I remember the Hollywood Bowl used to do these shows where they would play a movie, like let's say Beauty and the Beast or something, and they'd have actors come in to sing the songs, and then there was a live orchestra playing and you'd watch the movie.
I think I remember hearing about that. Yeah.
Yeah. They were amazing. They did The Little Mermaid and they were just really just nice moments. And I would probably want to do that at night and then maybe in the in-between take like a tap dancing class for fun or something. And probably write at some point.
No, that's funny. So the big breakfast, Anthony Bourdain mentioning that. And one of the things he turned me on to the idea of like, it doesn't have to be a sweet, whatever. You can have a big bowl of like Asian noodles, but it's spicy. So I've kind of got a thing. Well, it's the Texas part of me. I like I have something called chilaquiles, which are really big. Like kind of a spicy.
Oh,
big...
I love spicy. If I could end the day with a bowl of cereal, that would really like cap everything off. But I love spicy in general, I was going to say. So I'm a big fan of that.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Now the next question I've got. If you weren't doing this, you weren't doing something in this creative realm, they said, okay, no more movies or TV. What would your vocation be? What would be the thing that turns you on?
Oh, God. I think I just was thinking about this the other day. My answer used to always be like I'd like to like own a bakery in Europe or something and just you know, make cookies and stuff. But lately I've kind of, I mean, if I really couldn't do movies or TV, I'd probably write books. Like, I'd probably write beachy rom-com books about, like, characters that have to fake a relationship in order to go to a wedding or something. Just because I think those make a lot of people happy and they're very fun.
You said BG rom-com?
A beach read. Beach read rom-com.
Beach read. Like the beach, kind of, oh, okay. I got
yes.
you.
The very light, fluffy, heartwarming kind of books.
But the last question I've got for you. If you had a DeLorean, you can cruise back in time and connect with 16-year-old Asha. What piece of advice would you offer yourself that would be to get you on a better track or maybe to bring more joy to your life in that moment? What would you tell yourself?
To try and live in the moment as much as possible. I think when you're, I was a kid who knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to write TV, especially by 16. And so much of my life was like, you know, the kind of cliche teenager, I gotta get out of this town and make it to the city. And no part of me wants to go back and relive high school or college at all. But, you know, I think I wanted to grow up very quickly. I wanted to, you know, be where I am now, to be honest. And where I am now is great. But where I was then was great too. And I think it's hard to remember that sometimes. So I'd probably say that.
It's funny. I was speaking with Neil deGrasse Tyson and asked him the same thing. And he's like, that's kind of a farcical question. I mean, I understood his perspective because anything there, you're creating a whole new universe for yourself because every
creating thing happens, paradoxes, of course.
Exactly. You know, so well, I so appreciate your time again. And I wish you all the best. I'm looking forward to seeing your name showing up in more and more credits. And most
Thank
certainly,
you.
But you
it's
have
so
your,
great to meet you.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure. Now, please, next time, since you're a food person, next time you're on Fairfax, you go to Cantor's, please get some of the matzo ball soup for me.
I will, absolutely.
All right, Asha, Michelle Wilson, enjoy this chat. Very cool. We kind of, you know, pulled the curtain back, learned a little bit more about TV, how it's made, writing for TV. Glad to have her on the show. And tell you what, the website, storyandcraftpod.com, everything you could possibly want to know about the show is at storyandcraftpod.com. That's where you can shoot me a note, follow the show on social media, find out about the guests, pretty much anything and everything Story and Craft is at storyandcraftpod.com. All right, that's it for this episode. Looking forward to the next one and look forward to seeing you then right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.